Welcome to Ellery Queen's Mystery Magazine's Fiction Podcast. I'm Janet Hutchings, Ellery Queen's Mystery Magazine's editor. Our selection this month is a story by Carolyn Hart, an author often hailed as America's Agatha Christie. With nearly 4 dozen novels to her credit and 3 million books in print, she's certainly one of America's most popular mystery writers, and her 3 series, one featuring mystery bookstore owner Annie Lawrence, another following the cases of retired newspaperwoman Henrietta O'Dwyer, and the latest starring ghost sleuth Bailey Ruth Rayburn, have all been critically acclaimed as well. The story the Oklahoma author reads for this podcast is not really a series tale, however. Its central character, the young girl Gretchen Gilman, does appear again in the 2003 novel Letter from Home, but that book, like this story, was really a standalone. After Carolyn Hart's reading of her story Spooked from our March 1999 issue, I hope you'll join Carolyn and me, and authors Nancy Picard and Margaret Maron, for an interview conducted at the Malice Domestic Convention in Arlington, Virginia, in May of this year.
Spooked by Carolyn Hart. The dust from the convoy rose in plumes. Gretchen stood on tiptoe, waving. A soldier leaned over the tailgate of the olive-drab troop carrier. The blazing July sun touched his crew cut with gold. He grinned as he tossed her a bubble gum. "Chew it for me, kid." Gretchen wished she could run alongside, give him some of Grandmother Lottie's biscuits and honey. But his truck was 20 feet another, and another one rumbled in front of her. She ran a few steps, called out, "Good luck! Good luck!" The knobby piece of gum was a precious lump in her hand. She stood on the edge of the highway until the last truck passed. Grandmother said Highway 66 went all the way to California, and the soldiers were on their way to big ships to sail across the ocean to fight the Japs. Gretchen wished she could do something for the war. Her brother Jimmy was a Marine, somewhere in the South Pacific. He'd survived Iwo Jima. Every month they sent him cookies, peanut butter and oatmeal raisin and spice, packed in popcorn. When they had enough precious sugar, they made Aunt Bill's candy, but Mom had to find the sugar in Tulsa. Mr. Hudson's general store here in town almost never had sacks of sugar. Every morning she and Grandmother sat in a front pew of the little frame church in the willows and prayed for Jimmy and for all the boys overseas and for Gretchen's mom working so hard at the defense plant in Tulsa. Her mom only came home about 1 weekend a month. Grandmother tried to save a special piece of meat when she could. Grandmother said her mom was thin as a rail and working too hard. But Gretchen knew it was important for her mom to work. They needed everybody to help. And Mom was proud that she put radio parts in the big B-24 Liberators. Gretchen took a deep breath of the hot, heavy air, still laced with dust, and walked across the street to the cafe. Ever since the war started, they'd been busy from early morning until they ran out of food, sometimes around 5 o'clock. Never later than 7. Of course, they had special ration books for the cafe. But Grandmother said they couldn't use those points to get sugar for Jimmy. That wouldn't be right. Gretchen shaded her eyes and looked at the plate glass window. She still felt a kind of thrill when she saw the name painted in bright blue, Victory Cafe. A thrill, but also a tightness in her chest. The kind of feeling she once had when she climbed the big sycamore to get the calico kitten and a branch snap beneath her feet. For an instant that seemed to last forever, she was falling. She whopped against a thick limb and held on tight. She remembered the sense of strangeness as she fell, and disbelief, the thought that this couldn't be happening to her. There was a strangeness in the cafe's new name. It had been Pfizer's Cafe for almost 20 years, but now it didn't do to be proud of being German. Now Grandmother didn't say much in the cafe because her accent was thick. She was careful not to say ja and she let Gretchen do most of the talking. Grandmother prayed for Jimmy and for her sister's family in Hamburg. Gretchen tucked the bubble gum in the pocket of her pedal pushers. Grandmother wouldn't let her wear shorts, even though it was so hot the cotton stuck to her legs. She glanced at the big thermometer hanging by the door. 98 degrees and just past 1 o'clock. They'd sure hit over 100 today, just like every day for the past few weeks. They kept the front door propped, hoping for a little breeze through the screen. The cafe was almost as much her home as the boxy 3-bedroom frame house, a half mile away down a dirt road. Her earliest memories were playing with paper dolls in a corner of the kitchen, as her mother and grandmother worked hard and fast, fixing country breakfasts for truck drivers in a hurry to get to Tulsa and on to Oklahoma City and Amarillo with their big rigs. Every morning, grizzled old men from around the county gathered at Pfizer's for their newspapers and gossip, as well as for rashers of bacon, a short stack, and scrambled eggs. But everything changed with the war. Camp Crowder, just over the line in Missouri, brought in thousands of soldiers. Of course, they were busy training, but khaki uniforms were no stranger to the Victory Cafe, even though the menu wasn't what it had been before the war. Now they had meatless Tuesdays, and Grandmother fixed huge batches of macaroni and cheese. Sometimes there wasn't any bacon, but they had scrambled eggs and grits and fried potatoes. Instead of roast beef, they had hash, the potatoes and meat bubbly in a vinegary sauce. But Grandmother never fixed red cabbage or sauerkraut anymore. It was up to Gretchen to help her grandmother when her mom moved to Tulsa. She might only be 12, but she was wiry and strong, and she promised herself she'd never complain, not once, not ever, not for the duration. That's what everybody talked about, the duration until someday the war was over. On summer evenings, she was too tired to play kick the can, and it seemed a long ago memory when she used to climb up into the maple tree, carrying a stack of movie magazines, and nestle with her back to the trunk and legs dangling. She gave a swift professional glance around the square room. The counter with red leather at stools was to the left. The mirror behind the counter sparkled. She'd stood on a stool to polish it after lunch. Now it reflected her. Black pigtails, a skinny face with blue eyes that often looked tired and worried, and a pink ship and shore blouse and green pedal pushers. Her blouse had started the day crisp and starched, but now it was limp and spattered with bacon grease. 4 tables sat in the center. 3 wooden booths ran along the back wall, and 2 booths to the right. The jukebox was tucked between the back booths and the swinging door to the kitchen. It was almost always playing. She loved Stardust and Chattanooga Choo Choo, but the most often played song was Praise the Lord and Pass the Ammunition. A poster on the wall beside the jukebox pictured a sinking ship and a somber Uncle Sam with a finger to his lips and the legend, Loose Lips Sink Ships. Grandmother told her it meant no one should talk about the troop convoys that went through on Highway 66 or where they were going, or talk about soldiers' letters that sometimes carried information that got past the censors. Grandmother said that's why they had to be so careful about the food, to make sure there was enough for Jimmy and all the other boys. And that's why they couldn't drive to Tulsa to see Mom. There wasn't enough gas. Grandmother said even a cup full of gas might make a difference one day, whether some boy, like Jimmy, lived or died. 2 of the front tables needed clearing, but she made a circuit of the occupied places first. Deputy Sheriff Carter flicked his cigar, and ash dribbled onto his paunch, which started just under his chin and pooched against the edge of the table. He frowned at black and white squares on the newspaper page. He looked at Mr. Hudson across the table, You know a word for mountain ridge, five letters? He chewed on his pencil. Oh, yeah, he murmured. He marked the letters, closed the paper, leaned back in the booth. Heard they'd been grading a road out near the Macklemore place. Mr. Hudson clanked his spoon against the thick white coffee mug. Got some more Java, Gretchen? She nodded. Mr. Hudson pursed his thin mouth. Bud Macklemore's son-in-law is a county commissioner, you. What do you expect? Gretchen hurried to the hot plates behind the counter, brought the steaming coffee pot, refilled both men's mugs. The deputy sheriff's face looked like an old ham, crusted in pink. Never no flies on Bud. Maybe my youngest girl will get herself a county commissioner. Of course, she spends most of her time at the USO in Tulsa. But she's making good money at the Douglas plant. $40 a week. Then he frowned. But it's sure given her big ideas. Gretchen moved on to the next booth, refilled the cups for some army officers who had a map spread out on the table. The younger officer looked just like Alan Ladd. I've got it marked in a grid, sir. Here's the last five places they spotted the spook light. The bigger man fingered his little black mustache. Lieutenant, I want men out in the field every night. We're damn all going to get to the bottom of this business. Gretchen took her time moving away. The spook light. Everybody in town knew the Army had set up a special camp about 6 miles out of town just to look for the spook light. Those balls of orange or white that rose from nowhere and flowed up and down hills hung like fiery globes in the scrawny bow-dark trees. Sometimes ran right up on porches or over barns. Some people said the bouncing globes of light were a reflection from headlights on Highway 66. Other folks scoffed because the lights had been talked about for 100 years, long before cars moved on the twisting road. Gretchen put the coffee on the hot plate, picked up a damp cloth and a tray. She set to work on the table closest to the Army officers. Sergeant Ferris swore this light was as big as a locomotive, and it came rolling and bouncing down the road, went right over the truck like seltzer water bouncing in a soda glass. Now you can't tell me, the black mustache bristled, that burning gas acts like that. No, sir. The lieutenant sounded just like Cornel Wilde saluting a general in that movie about the fall of Corregidor. The kitchen door squeaked open. Her grandmother's red face, naturally ruddy skin flushed with heat from the stove, brightened, and she smiled. But she didn't say a word. When Gretchen was little, she would have caroled, "Come here, mein Schatz." Now she waved her flowery hands. Gretchen carried the dirty dishes into the kitchen. The last words she heard were like an Abbott and Costello radio show, a nonsensical mixture. Soon as the war's over, set up search parties. I'm going to see if I can patch those tires. Good training for night. Four pies sat on the center table, steam still rising from the latticed crust. The smell of apples and cinnamon and a hint of nutmeg overlay the onions and liver and fried okra cooked for lunch. Oh, grandmother, Gretchen's eyes shone. Apple pie was her most favorite food in all the world. Then, without warning, she felt a hot prick of tears. Jimmy loved apple pie, too. Grandmother's big blue eyes were suddenly soft. She was heavy and moved slowly, but her arms soon enveloped Gretchen. No tears. Tomorrow we send Jimmy a stolen rich with our own pecans. Now let's take our pies to the counter. But first, she used a sharp knife, cut a generous wedge, scooped it out, and placed it on a plate. I have saved one piece, ein, for you. The pie plates were still warm. Gretchen held the door for her grandmother. It was almost like a festive procession as they carried the pies to the counter. The officers watched. Mr. Hudson's nose wrinkled in pleasure. Deputy Carter pointed at the pie plate. Hey, Lottie, I'll sure take one of those. There was a chorus of calls. Grandmother dished up the pieces, handing the plates to Gretchen, then stood at the end of the counter, sprigs of silver-streaked blonde hair loose from her coronet braids, her blue eyes happy, her plump hands folded on her flowery apron. Gretchen refilled all the coffee cups. Grandmother was behind the cash register when Mr. Hudson paid his check. "Lottie, the deputy may have to put you in jail. You make any more pies like that." Grandmother's face was suddenly still. She looked at him in bewilderment. Mr. Hudson cackled. "You sure don't have enough sugar to make that many pies. You've been dealing in the black market?" Grandmother's hand shook as she held them up as if to stop a careening horse. "Oh, no, not black market, never. I use honey. Honey my cousin Ernst makes himself." The officers were waiting with their checks. The younger blonde man, the one who looked like Alan Ladd, smiled warmly. "Sprechen Sie Deutsch? Dies ist der beste Apfelkuchen, den ich je gegessen habe." The deputy tossed down a quarter, a dime and a nickel for macaroni and cheese, coleslaw, pie, and coffee. He glowered at Grandmother. "No heiny talk needed around here, that right, Lottie?" He glared at the soldier. "How come you speak it so good?" The blonde officer was a much smaller man, but Gretchen loved the way he looked at the deputy like he was a piece of banana peel. "Too bad you don't have a German Grossmutter like she and I do," he nodded toward Gretchen. "We're lucky, you know," and he gave Grandmother a gentle smile. "Danke schön." But Grandmother's shoulders were drawn tight. She made the change without another word, not looking at any of the men. And when they turned toward the front door, she scuttled to the kitchen. Gretchen waited a moment, then darted after her. Grandmother stood against the back wall, her apron to her face, her shoulders shaking. "Don't cry, Grandmother." Now it was Gretchen who stood on tiptoe to hug the big woman. Her grandmother wiped her face and said, her accent even more pronounced than usual, "We have work to do enough now." As her grandmother stacked the dirty dishes in the sink, Gretchen took a clean recipe card. She searched through the file, then printed in large block letters, "Lottie's Apple Honey Victory Pie. 6 tart apples, 1 cup honey, 2 tablespoons flour, 1 teaspoon cinnamon, - nutmeg, - salt, pastry." She took the card and propped it by the cash register. Back in the kitchen, Grandmother scrubbed the dishes in hot soapy water, then hefted a tea kettle to pour boiling water over them as they drained. Gretchen mopped the floor. Every so often, the bell jangled from the front, and Gretchen hurried out to take an order. The pie and all the food were gone before 5. Grandmother turned the sign in the front window to close. Then she walked wearily to the counter and picked up the recipe Gretchen had scrawled. "Let's leave it there, Grandmother." Gretchen was surprised at how stern she sounded. Her grandmother almost put it down, then shook her head. "We don't want to make the deputy mad, Gretchen." Gretchen hated hearing the fear in her grandmother's voice. She wanted to insist that the recipe remain. She wanted to say that they hadn't done anything wrong, and they shouldn't have to be afraid. But she didn't say anything else as her grandmother held the card tight to her chest and turned away. "You go on home, Grandmother. I'll close up." Gretchen held up her hands as her grandmother started to protest. "You know I like to close up." She'd made a game of it months ago, because she knew Grandmother was so tired by closing time that she almost couldn't walk the half mile to the house. And there was still the garbage to haul down to the incinerator, and the menus to stack, and silverware to roll up in the clean gingham napkins, and potatoes to scrub for tomorrow, and the jam and jelly jars to be wiped with a hot rag. Gretchen made 3 trips to the incinerator, hauling the trash in a wheelbarrow. She liked the creak of the wheel, and the caw of the crows, and even though it was so hot she felt like an egg on a sizzling griddle. It was fun to use a big kitchen match and set the garbage on fire. She had to stay until she could stir the ashes, be sure the fire was out. She tipped the wheelbarrow over and stood on it to reach up and catch a limb and climb the big cottonwood. She climbed high enough to look out over the town, at the cafe and at McGrory's gas station, and at the flag hanging limp on the pole outside the post office. If it hadn't been for the ugly way the deputy had acted to Grandmother, Gretchen probably would never have paid any attention to him. But he'd been mean, and she glowered at him through the shifting leaves of the cottonwood. He didn't see her, of course. He was walking along the highway. A big truck zoomed over the hill. When the driver spotted the deputy's high-crowned black hat and khaki uniform, he abruptly slowed. But the deputy wasn't paying any attention. He was just strolling along, his hands in his pockets, almost underneath Gretchen's tree. A hot day for a walk. Too hot a day for a walk. Gretchen wiped her sticky face against the collar of her blouse. She craned for a better look. Oh, the deputy was turning into the graveyard, nestled on the side of the hill near the church. The graveyard was screened from most of the town by a stand of enormous evergreens, so only Gretchen and the crows could see past the mossy stone pillars and the metal arch. Gretchen frowned and remembered the time when Mrs. Whittle caught Sammy Cooper out in the hall without a pass. She'd never forgotten the chagrin on Sammy's face when Mrs. Whittle said, "Samuel, the next time you plan to cut class, don't walk like you had the Hope Diamond in your pocket and there's a policeman on every corner." Gretchen wasn't sure what the Hope Diamond was, but every time any of the kids saw Sammy for the next year, they'd whistle and shout, "Got the Hope Diamond, Sammy?" The deputy stopped in a huge swath of shade from an evergreen. He peered around the graveyard. What did he expect to see? Nobody there could look at him. Gretchen forgot how hot she was. She even forgot to be mad. She leaned forward and grabbed the closest limb, moved it so she could see better. The deputy made a full circle of the graveyard, which is maybe half as big as a football field, no more than 40 or 50 headstones. He passed by the stone angel at Grandpa Fizer's grave and her dad's stone that had a weeping willow on it. That was the old part of the cemetery. A mossy stone, half fallen on one side, marked the grave of a Confederate soldier. Mrs. Peters took Gretchen's social studies class there last year and showed them how to do a rubbing of a stone, even though the inscription was scarcely legible. Gretchen shivered when she saw the wobbly, indistinct gray letters. Hiram Kelly, age 19, wounded July 17, 1863, in the Battle of Honey Springs, died July 29, 1863. Beloved son of Robert and Effie Kelly, cherished brother of Corinne Kelly. Some of the graves still had little American flags placed there for the fourth. A half dozen big sprays marked the most recent grave. Back by the pillars, the deputy made one more careful study of the church and the graveyard. Then he pulled a folded sheet of paper from his pocket and knelt by the west pillar. He tugged at a stone about 3 inches from the ground. Gretchen couldn't believe her eyes. She leaned so far forward her branch creaked. The kneeling man's head jerked up. Gretchen froze quieter than a tick on a dog. The sun glistened on his face, giving it an unhealthy, coppery glow. The eyes that skittered over the headstones and probed the lengthening shadows were dark and dangerous. A crow cawed. A heavy truck rumbled over the hill, down Main Street. The faraway wail of Cal Burke's saxophone sounded sad and lonely. Gradually, the tension eased out of the deputy's shoulders. He turned and jammed the paper into the small dark square and poked the stone over the opening, like capping a jar of preserves. He lunged to his feet and strode out of the cemetery, relaxing to a casual saunter once past the church. Gretchen waited until he climbed in his old black Ford and drove down the dusty road. She swung down from the tree, thumped onto the wheelbarrow, and jumped to the ground. The bells in the steeple rang 6 times. She had to hurry. Grandmother would have a light supper ready. Pork and beans and a salad with her homemade Thousand Island dressing and a big slice of watermelon. Gretchen tried not to look like she had the Hope Diamond in her pocket. Instead, she whistled as though calling a dog and clapped her hands. A truck roared past on its way north to Joplin. Still whistling, she ran to the stone post. Once hidden from the road, she worked fast. The oblong slab of stone came right off in her hand. She pulled out the sheet of paper, unfolded it. She'd had geography last spring with Mrs. Jacobs. She'd made an A. She liked maps, liked the way you could take anything, a mountain, a road, an ocean, and make it come alive on a piece of paper. She figured this one at a glance. The straight line, though the road really curved and climbed and fell, was Highway 66. The little squiggle slanting off to the northeast from McGrory Station was the dusty road that led to an abandoned zinc mine, the Sister Sioux. The X was a little off the road, just short of the mine entrance. There was a round clock face at the top of the sheet. The hands were set at midnight. She stuffed the folded sheet in its dark space, replaced the stone. X marks the spot. Not a treasure map. That was kid stuff in stories by Robert Louis Stevenson. But nobody hid a note in a stone post unless they were up to something bad, something they didn't want anybody to know about. Tonight, something secret was going to happen. Gretchen pulled the sheet up to her chin, even though the night oozed heat like the stoves at the cafe. She was dressed, a t-shirt and shorts, and her sneakers were on the floor. She waited until 11, watching the slow crawl of the hands on her alarm clock and listening to the summer dance of the June bugs against her window screen. She unhooked the screen, sat on the sill, and dropped to the ground. She wished she could ride her bike, but somebody might be out on the road and see her, and they'd sure tell Grandmother. Instead, she figured out the shortest route, cutting across the McClellan farm, careful to avoid the pasture where old Amos glared out at the world with reddish eyes, and slipping in the shadows down Purdy Road. The full moon hung low in the sky, its milky radiance creating a black and cream world, making it easy to see. She stayed in the shadows. The buzz of the cicadas was so loud, she kept a close eye out for headlights coming over the hill or around the curve. Once near the abandoned mine, she moved from shadow to shadow, smelling the sharp scent of the evergreens, feeling the slippy dried needles underfoot. A tremulous, wavering, plaintive shriek hurt her ears. Slowly, it subsided into a moan. Gretchen's heart raced. A sudden flap, and an owl launched into the air. Gretchen looked uneasily around the clearing. The boarded-over mine shaft was a dark mound straight ahead. There was a cave-in years ago, and they weren't able to get to the miners in time. In the dark, the curved mound looked like a huge gravestone. The road, rutted and overgrown, curved past the mine entrance and ended in front of a ramshackle storage building, perhaps half as large as a barn. A huge padlock hung from a rusty chain wound around the big splintery board that barred the double doors. Nothing moved, though the night was alive with sound, frogs croaking, cicadas rasping. Gretchen found a big sycamore on the hillside. She climbed high enough to see over the cleared area. She sat on a fat limb, her back to the trunk, her knees to her chin. The cicada chorus was so loud she didn't hear the car. It appeared without warning, headlights off, lurching in the deep ruts, crushing an overgrowth of weeds as it stopped off the road to one side of the storage shed. The car door slammed. In the moonlight, the deputy's face was a pale mask. As she watched, that pale mask turned ever so slowly all the way around the clearing. Gretchen hunkered into a tight crouch. She felt prickles of cold, though it was so hot sweat beaded her face, slipped down her arms and legs. A cigarette lighter flared. The end of the deputy's cigar was a red spot. He leaned inside the car, dragging out something. Metal clanked as he placed the things on the front car fender. Suddenly he turned toward the rutted lane. Gretchen heard the dull rumble, too, loud enough to drown out the cicadas. Dust swirled in a thick cloud as the wheels of the army truck churned the soft ruts. The sheriff was already moving. He propped a big flashlight on the car fender. By the time the driver turned and backed the truck, with its rear end facing the shed, the sheriff was snipping the chain. The driver of the truck wore a uniform. He jumped down and ran to help, and the two men lifted up the big splintery board, tossed it aside. Each man grabbed a door. They grunted and strained and pulled, and finally both doors were wide open. The soldier hurried to the back of the truck, let down the metal back. Gretchen strained to catch glimpses of the soldier as he moved back and forth past the light. Tall and skinny, he had a bright bald spot on the top of his head, short dark hair on the sides. His face was bony with a beaked nose and a chin that sank into his neck. He had sergeant stripes on his sleeves. He was a lot smaller and skinnier than the deputy, but he was twice as fast. They both moved back and forth between the truck and the shed, carrying olive green gasoline tins in each hand. Once the sergeant barked, "Get a move on. I've got to get that truck back damn quick." Even in the moonlight, the deputy's face looked dangerously red, and he huffed for breath. He stopped occasionally to mop his face with an oversized handkerchief. The sergeant never paused, and he shot a sour look at the bigger man. Gretchen tried to count the tens. She got confused, but was sure there were at least 40, maybe a few more. When the last ten was inside the shed, the door shoved shut, the chains wrapped around the board, the deputy rested against his car, his breathing as labored as a bulldogger struggling with a calf. The sergeant planted himself square in front of the gasping deputy and held out his hand. "God damn, man," the deputy's wind whistled in his throat. "You gotta wait till I sell the stuff. I worked out a deal with a guy in Tulsa. Top price. A lot more than we could get around here. Besides, black market gas out here might get traced right back to us." "I want my money." The sergeant's reedy voice sounded edgy and mean. "Look, fella." The deputy pushed away from the car, glowered down at the smaller man. "You'll get your goddamn money when I get mine." The soldier didn't move an inch. "Okay, that's good. When do you get yours?" The deputy didn't answer. "When's the man coming?" "We'll meet him together." A hard laugh. "We can split the money right then and there." The deputy wiped his face and neck with his handkerchief. "Sure, you can help us load. Thursday night, same time." "I'll be here." The sergeant moved fast to the truck, climbed into the front seat. After he revved the motor, he leaned out the window. "I'll be here, and you damn sure better be." Grandmother settled the big blue bowl in her lap, began to snap green beans. Gretchen was so tired, her eyes burned and her feet felt like lead. She swiped the paring knife around the potato. "Grandmother, what does it mean when people talk about selling gas on the black market?" Grandmother's hand moved so fast, snap, snap, snap. "We don't have much of that around here. Everyone tries hard to do right. The gas has to be used by people like the farmers and Dr. Sherman so he can go to sick people and the army. The black market is very wrong, Gretchen. Why, what if there weren't enough gas for the jeeps and tanks where Jimmy is? There wasn't much sound then, but the snap of beans and the soft squish as the potato peelings fell into the sink. Gretchen tossed the last potato into the big pan of gold water. Grandmother, she scooped up the potato peels. Who catches these people in the black market? Grandmother carried her bowl to the sink. I don't know, she said uncertainly. I guess in the cities, the police. And here it would be the deputy, or maybe the army. Gretchen put the dirty dishes on the tray, swiped the cloth across the table. Deputy Carter grunted, "Bring me some more coffee." But he didn't look up from his copy of the newspaper. He frowned as he printed words in the crossword puzzle. Across the room, the officer who looked like Alan Ladd was by himself. He smiled at Gretchen. "Tell your grandmother this is the best food I've had since I was home." Gretchen smiled shyly at him. Then she blurted, Are you still looking for the spook light?" His eyebrows scooted up like snapped window shades. "How'd you know that?" She polished the table, slid him an uncertain look. I heard you yesterday, she said softly. "Oh, sure. Well," he leaned forward conspiratorially, "my colonel thinks it's a great training tool to have the troops search for mystery lights. The first platoon to find them's going to get a free weekend pass." Gretchen wasn't sure what a training tool was or a free pass, but she focused on what mattered to her. You mean the soldiers are still looking for the lights? They'll come where the lights are? Fast as they can. Of course, he shrugged. Nobody knows when or where they're going to appear. So it's mostly a lot of hiking around in the dark and nothing happens. Gretchen looked toward the deputy. He was frowning as he scratched out a word, wrote another one. She turned until her back was toward the sheriff. They say that in July, the lights dance around the old Sister Sue mine. That's what I heard the other day. Behind her, she heard the creak as the sheriff slid out of the booth, clumped toward the cash register. "Excuse me," she said quickly, and she turned away. The sheriff paid 45 cents total, 30 for the meatless Tuesday vegetable plate, 10 for a raisin pie, a nickel for coffee. When the door closed behind him, Gretchen hurried to the table. As she cleared it, she carefully tucked the discarded newspaper under her arm. "A cherry phosphate, please," she slid onto the hard metal stool. The soda fountain at Thompson's Drugs didn't offer comfortable stools like those at the Victory Cafe. "Cherry phosphate," Millard Thompson corrected. He gave her his sweet smile that made his round face look like a cheerful pumpkin topped by tight coils of red hair. Millard was 2 years older than she, and had lived across the alley all her life. He played the tuba in the junior high band, had collected more tin cans than anybody in town, and knew which shrubs the butterflies liked. Once he led her on a long walk, scrambling through the rugged Bodark to a little valley covered with thousands of monarchs. And in the Thompson washroom, he had 2 shelves full of chemicals, and sometimes he let her watch his experiments. He even had a Bunsen burner. And Millard's big brother Mike was in the 45th, now part of General Patton's 7th Army. They hadn't heard from him since the landings in Sicily, and there was a haunted look in Mrs. Thompson's eyes. Mr. Thompson had a big map at the back of the store, and he moved red pins along the invasion route. Mike's unit was reported fighting for the Commisso Airport. Gretchen looked around the store, but it was quiet in mid-afternoon. Millard's mother was arranging perfumes and powders on a shelf behind the cash register. His dad was in the back of the store behind the pharmacy counter. "Millard," she kept her voice low, "do you know about the black market?" He leaned his elbow on the counter. "See if I got enough cherry in." "Yeah, sure, Gretchen. Dad says it's as bad as being a spy. He says people who sell on the black market make blood money. He says they don't deserve to have guys like Mike ready to die for them." Gretchen loved cherry phosphates. Okay, she knew it was phosphate. but it had always sounded like phosphate to her. But she just held tight to the tall beaded Sunday glass. "Okay, then, listen, Miller." Gretchen struggled to stay awake. She waited a half hour after Grandmother turned off her light, then slipped from her window. Millard was waiting by Big Angus's pasture. As they hurried along Purdy Lane, Millard asked, "You sure it was Deputy Carter? And he said it was for the black market?" "Yes." Millard didn't answer, but she knew he was struggling with the truth that they couldn't go to the man who was supposed to catch bad guys. When they pulled the shed doors wide and he shone his flashlight over the dozens and dozens of 5-gallon gasoline tins, he gave a low whistle. Being Millard, he picked up a tin, unscrewed the cap, smelled. "Gas, all right." There was a definite change in Millard's voice when he spoke. He sounded more grown up and very serious. "We got to do something, Gretchen." She knew that. That's why she'd come to him. "I know." She, too, sounded somber. "Listen, Millard, I got an idea." He listened intently while she spoke. Then he looked around the clearing. His round face was intent, measuring. Then he grinned. "Sure, sure we can. Dad's got a bunch of powdered magnesium out in the storeroom. They used to use it with the old-fashioned photography." He looked at her blank face. "For the flash, Gretchen. Here's what we'll do." Gretchen could scarcely bear the relief that flooded through her when the young lieutenant stopped in for coffee and pie Wednesday afternoon. When she refilled his cup, she said quickly, "Will you look for the spook light tonight?" The lieutenant sighed. "Every night. Don't know why the darn things disappeared just when we started looking for it. A friend of mine saw it last night, near the Sister Sue mine." She gripped her cleaning cloth tightly. "If you'll look there tonight, I'm sure you'll find it." It was cloudy Wednesday night. Gretchen and Millard moved quickly around the clearing, Gretchen clambering up in the trees, Millard handing her the pie tin she'd brought from the kitchen. She scrambled to high branches, fastened the tins with duct tape. She was panting by the time she finished. She tried to catch her breath as Millard unwrapped the chain to the big shed. The big chain clanked as he tossed it aside. Gretchen helped him tug the doors wide open. She stepped inside and carefully tucked the newspaper, discarded by the sheriff, between two tins. Millard was a dark shadow behind her. "Do you think they'll come?" "Yes. Oh, Millard, I believe they will. I do." There had been a sudden sharpness in the young officer's eyes. She'd had the feeling he really listened to her. Maybe she felt that way because she wanted it so badly. But there was a calmness in her heart. He would come. He would come. Millard took his place high in the branches of an oak that grew close to the boarded over mine shaft. Gretchen clutched the huge oversized flashlight and checked over in her mind which trees had the pie tins and how she could move in the shadows to reach them. Suddenly, Millard began to scramble down from the tree. "Gretchen, Gretchen, where are you?" "Over here, Millard." She moved out into the clearing. "What's wrong?" He was panting. "It's the army, but they're going down the wrong road. They're on the road to Hell Hollow. They won't come close enough to see us." Gretchen could hear the noise now from the road on the other side of the hill. I'll go through the woods. I've got my stuff." And Millard disappeared in the night. Gretchen almost followed, but if Millard decoyed them this way, she had to be ready to do her part. Suddenly, a light burst in the sky, and it would be easily seen from Hell Hollow Road. Nobody who knew Beans would have thought it was a spook light, but by golly, it was an odd, unexplained flash in the night sky. Then came another flash and another. Shouts erupted. "Look, look, there it is! Quick, this way, over the hill!" If Millard had been there, she would have hugged him. He'd taken lumps of the powdered magnesium, wrapped them in net, Gretchen found an old dress of her mom's and cut off the net petticoat, and added string wicks that he dipped, he told her earnestly, in a strong solution of potassium nitrate. Now he was lighting the wicks and using his slingshot to toss the soon-to-explode packets high in the air. Gretchen heard Millard crashing back through the woods. He just had time to climb the oak when the soldiers swarmed into the clearing. Gretchen slithered from shadow to shadow, briefly shining the flash high on the tens. The reflected light quivered oddly in the high branches. She made her circuit, then slipped beneath a thick pine and lay on her stomach to watch. Two more flares shone in the sky, and then three in succession blazed up right in front of the open shed doors. The local Gazette used headlines as big as the invasion of Sicily in its Friday edition. Army unit finds black market gas at Sister Sue mine. Army authorities revealed Thursday afternoon that unexplained light flashing in the sky Wednesday night led a patrol to a cache of stolen gasoline. It was the talk of the town. 5 days later, when Deputy Sheriff Ewell Carter was arrested, the local breakfast crowd was fascinated to hear from Mr. Hudson, who heard it from someone who heard it on the Post. You know how you always did them damn fool crossword puzzles? Well, Mr. Hudson leaned across the table. Seems he left a newspaper right there in the storage shed, and the puzzle was all filled out in his handwriting. Joe Bob Terrell from the Gazette recognized his handwriting, said he'd seen it a million times in arrest records. The newspaper had Ewell's fingerprints all over it, and they found his prints on the gas tins. They traced the tins to Camp Crowder, and they checked the prints of everybody in the motor pool, and found some from this sergeant, and his were on half the tins, on the boards that sealed up that shack by the Sister Sue. They've got him dead to right. Gretchen poured more coffee and smiled. At lunch, the nice officer, she'd known he would come that night. He had left her a big tip. He looked at her, almost asked a question, then shook his head. She could go to Thompson's for a cherry phosphate in a little while and tell Millard everything she'd heard. It was too bad they couldn't tell everyone how clever Millard had been with the magnesium. But that was okay. What really mattered was the gas. Now maybe there'd be enough for Jimmy and Mike.
Spooked is copyrighted by Carolyn Hart. It was recorded at the Malice Domestic Convention, as was the following interview, which was squeezed into everyone's schedule late one evening. Good evening.
I'm very lucky tonight to be at the Boucher... at the Malice Domestic Convention in Washington, D.C., where I'm joined by three absolutely wonderful authors. Carolyn Hart, who has written many series, among them Henry O., who has appeared in Ellery Queen's Mystery Magazine at short story length and also appears at novel length, of course. And Margaret Maron, who has written stories in her Sigrid Herald series for EQMM and also writes those stories at novel length. And Nancy Picard, who has written Marie Lightfoot stories for us and also does that series at novel length, and Jenny Kane, of course, that she's well known for. Too many credits for all of these great writers to go into now, but what interests me to start off with is that they write short stories and novels, and so I thought maybe we could talk a little bit about the difference between writing a short story and a novel and how you feel about each form. And why don't we start with... Margaret, who began her career with short stories.
Absolutely, start with me. I spent my first 12 years of my professional life, and I have not had a drink. I spent the first 12 years of my professional life writing short stories, and short stories was what I first sold, and this was where I had given my heart, and I thought this was all that I would ever do. And then the short story market sort of dried up, and I backed into writing novels. But I still do like the short story. And to me, the difference, which is not what you ask, but the difference between the short story and the novel is when I was writing short stories, I would get an idea for a plot, and then I would think of characters who could do the plot. so that it all seemed rather natural. When I came to write novels, I might have had started with an idea of a plot, but these characters would not jump through those hoops that I had prepared.
Isn't that interesting?
So I find that while short stories to me are more about plot, the novels are more about character. What do you think, Nancy?
I think that's true. Although I do really enjoy exploring character in short stories, I think because, although you can't get into them in depth, as I think you're implying, mm-hmm. I enjoy it because I will tackle characters in a short story that I would never tackle in a novel, mm-hmm. partly because they may be people I don't want to spend a novel's worth of time with. I recently had a short story published that was about a woman who killed her children. Well, I don't want to spend a novel's worth of time, months and months and months, with that mm-hmm. character, but I was happy to put her in a very short, very short, short story. And there are other situations like that, too, in which I'll think of a character that either it's somebody who's unpleasant enough that I don't want to spend that much of my time with, or somebody who about whom I can't really devise a long story, but I'd love to write something short about them.
Now, you did start with short stories, didn't you? In fact, didn't you debut in our Department of First Stories?
I did. Bless Ellery Queen's heart. Yeah, yeah. I departed. Let's hope not. I started in your Department of First Stories, but I started a novel at the same time. You were the first place I was published, but at the same time I was working on my first novel because I'd been a professional writer and I'd been a freelance writer, and one day, in a fit of madness, I gave all my clients, my paying clients, 30 days notice, and 30 days after that I was writing fiction full-time and have been doing that ever since. So when your acceptance came, it was just one of the greatest days of my life. And actually, if I may say something about your sister magazine, my second published short story was for Alfred Hitchcock's Mysterious Photograph.
Oh, was it really?
Yeah.
Oh, my gosh.
And what is that, 250 words?
Yes, it is 250 words. Yeah.
So when people talk about writing flash fiction these days, I think, well, I did that for Alfred Hitchcock.
So you can do any length, literally.
Yes.
Well, actually, I don't feel that I belong in this august company because I am not an accomplished short story writer. And I came to that kind of writing very late. I had written a great many novels before it ever came my way to be invited to do a short story for an anthology. And although now I find it easier to say no, at that point in my life, if anyone asked me to write anything, dog food recipes, whatever, I would try. And I find I have great respect for people who write short stories because they are able to take a little moment in time and bring it to life to the readers. And I think my problem is that I can't ever tell a story without going into enormous detail. And my husband will say when I'm trying to describe what happened during my day, well, yes, but yes, what happened? Get to the point. So I love short stories. I think they're wonderful. I wish I were better at it.
But actually, Carolyn, I have to say that in just, 7,000 words, maybe less, with the story you podcast for us, you've recreated a whole era. So you are able to do something in it. It's
Listen.
Quite significant in a short space.
7,000 words is a tenth of a novel for me.
Oh, okay.
She's on to me.
Yes.
It's like poetry. I think if a poem goes much past one page, maybe it's a short story.
Yeah.
If a short story goes much past 2,500 words, maybe it's mm-hmm. a book.
Well, yeah. And actually, the character in this particular short story went on to be the central character in a novel.
In Letters.
A Letter from Home.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So. Oh, I remember that short story. I loved that short story.
Thank you.
I was really happy when that became a novel.
Yeah, mm-hmm. I enjoyed writing it. You know, it.
See, you can enjoy writing.
Well, it's occasionally.
But you're already thinking as you're writing it of the book. Were you thinking of what?
Yes, I was. I was thinking about a book.
I
you know.
See.
Uh-huh. Yeah, that's where the first Deborah Knott came from. It was a short story, and Sarah Paretsky mm-hmm. did a Woman's Eye anthology, and asked me to do a short story,
oh,
and
yeah.
I. created Deborah Knott. I'd been thinking about doing this character, but that was the first time that I had actually tried out that first-person mm-hmm. smart-mouth persona. Mm-hmm. And I'll always be grateful to Sarah for doing
yes.
that anthology and inviting me to be in it, because, I mean, I'm sure Deborah would have come anyhow. But that short story gave me a chance to try
it.
The voice, mm-hmm. just as you did.
Mm-hmm. Exactly. Mm-hmm.
I had just the opposite experience in the fact that a short story has never given birth to a novel for me, but a short story for you, Janet, and Ellery Queen let me continue my trilogy of Marie Lightfoot after I wasn't
finished
going to do the
yeah.
series anymore. And so I got to do a long short story to spend a little more time with Marie, and I really loved being able to do that.
Do you think you'll do anything else with Marie?
I don't, unless it would be a short story. She was always going to be three books,
mm-hmm.
And so I don't think I will. Right. I was just going to say another advantage to me of working on short stories, a two-part advantage. One is you can finish them.
That's nice.
And the other is you can, I think, for me at least, get closer to having it turn out the way you originally envisioned it to be, or having it be as good as you wanted it to be, where with a novel, there are always parts that if I were smarter or better or had more time or whatever it is, I would go back in and rework some more. But I've written a few short stories that I think I wouldn't change.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't have that feeling with my novels. You all may have different experiences in that regard. But
no, you always want to smooth the cowlick and tuck
yeah.
in the shirt.
Oh, every time you go back over a book, you know, when I get a copy edited manuscript back. No, not copy edited, line edited, pardon me. I love that period of time because I'm going to go over every word, every sentence, every paragraph.
Mm-hmm.
And I will hear writers say, oh, well, they only had a few little things. And I'm thinking, well, why weren't you going over them?
Yeah,
you know,
right.
This is
yeah.
your
last chance
yeah.
before
this
the
is your last
yeah.
chance.
That's
yeah.
right.
You know.
And I recently, I shouldn't tell this probably, I recently discovered there was one more chance than I knew, which was to go over the second pass galleys of a book rather than just the first pass galleys.
To make sure they made the corrections
yes,
that you
exactly.
want. Yes.
Oh, yeah.
Interesting.
I know.
Yeah.
After all these years, I just found that out.
You mean they didn't make the changes that you had asked for?
Sometimes an error could occur.
That's right. Sometimes an error can occur. And
mm-hmm.
I had
never had that happen.
Well, I had a major change, mm-hmm. law change, in galleys this time.
Mm-hmm.
And so I really, and my publisher is wonderful. Copy chief, and I knew she'd do her best to get it in, but I was paranoid and wanted to make sure because it was so important to
yes.
the book.
Mm-hmm.
And in fact, one or two small things had not gotten in, although the big one had. So
mm-hmm.
I'm always going to, from now on, ask to see second pass, I think, to make
well,
sure.
Thank you, darling.
In.
I'm going
to
start
yeah,
asking too.
To
start
no, this is terrible. Copy chiefs, if any copy chief hears this, they've gone white.
But Nancy, you had mentioned to me once, I think, that you feel that the tone of your short stories may be very different from what you write at novel length.
Well, that's what my book editor says. She thinks my short stories are much cooler, chillier than my novel tone. And I think some of them are. I think there are some others I've written that she may not have read that have a warmer tone to them. But if I'm going to write a colder tone, I'm going to do it in short stories rather than in novels. Because, again, it comes down to what do I want to spend that much time
yes.
on? And I want to spend more time on something with more warmth
right.
than
mm-hmm.
I do with something that's cold.
I keep thinking of Blue Moon.
That was a cool one. It was definitely.
It really was a cool
yeah,
short story.
It was.
And where was that published, Nancy?
Was it your... I think it was your Valentine Day
was
anthology,
Was it the Valentine
Caroline?
Anthology?
Caroline.
Oh, I think it was. Uh-huh. I think it was.
Yeah.
Do you find anything... Has anybody commented to you that your stories are different in mood or tone from...
No, not really. I get that with the difference between the Sigrid Harrell books and the Deborah Knott books.
Uh-huh.
People tell me they don't seem as if they were written by the same person.
Yes.
Because I do mm-hmm. deliberately cramp my spirit when I'm writing Sigrid Harrell. And again, I have to thank her for letting me have another
mm-hmm.
bite of the apple mm-hmm. and do another Sigrid Harrell
mm-hmm. story. You mean Janet?
Yes.
Yes.
We had two stories, I think, since you stopped doing the novels.
Yes.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
I'm a finally getting a sense here that Ellery Queen's magazine is rather important to us. It's played really pivotal roles in all of our
when
careers.
When I first started writing short mystery stories, Ellery Queen was the pinnacle.
Oh, definitely. Definitely.
And people would say, you know, well, where should I send my this, that, or the other? And I always said, start at the top and work down. Mm-hmm. So I always started with Ellery Queen. And I always got the rejection slip back within 2 or 3 weeks. And my first short story was published in Alfred Hitchcock.
Mm-hmm. Which Eleanor was still editing then, though, right?
Janet wants to make sure it's not that she was not editing. No.
But I thought that maybe Eleanor was Eleanor at one point edited both magazines.
No,
so
Kathleen was
there?
No. It was when Ernie Hutter. Before
the company owned both magazines. Yes.
Yes.
Okay.
Yes. Ah. Hitchcock was a separate.
I see.
Entity, yeah. And I had sold several stories to Ernie Hutter, who was the editor down there in Florida, and I just thought Ellery Queen was the top, and then Alfred Hitchcock was next, and then it just sort of. You know, then you had Mike Shane, and you had The Executioner, and you had a lot of magazines that I put out of business.
They're not there anymore.
They're not there anymore, and I was in the last issue. I better not say this, or you won't buy any more.
I think it would have happened by now, Margaret, if I was going to, with your stories, but which story is going to be the one? Well, you're bringing up the different mood between the Sigrid stories and the Deborah Knott books brings me to another topic I wanted to ask you all, because you've all written mysteries at novel length, at least about set in small towns. Mm-hmm. And I wanted to ask you why you chose small towns. I mean, I know that the reason in some cases is that you're from small towns, but do you like writing mysteries in that type of setting, and how does it differ from choosing a city setting?
Well, I have done both, because some of the Henryo books are not in, they're on San Antonio, mm-hmm. and fairly places like that. But with the Death on Demand series, I wanted to set it on a sea island, so by definition,
yes.
It's going to be a small community. Yeah. And I do like writing about a small community, because people know more people. And the thing about the traditional mystery is that we're dealing with people who have relationships with many others around them. And it's when those relationships become twisted and soured that we have the basis for a mystery. And I think that we can focus. But, you know, anybody... Well, let me put it this way. When I wrote the book about the little town in Oklahoma that was set during World War II, Letter from Home, I grew up in Oklahoma City, and it was not a big town during the war years, but it was, 100,000, 200,000, something like that. And when Tony Hillerman, bless his dear, generous, kind heart, gave me a quote for Letter from Home, which is set in a very small northeastern Oklahoma town, and we were speaking on the phone, and Tony said, "What little town did you grow up in?" And I felt like someone had just handed me the moon. You see, Tony grew up in Sacred Heart, Oklahoma.
Oh.
So he really knew small towns in Oklahoma. So I don't know. What, Margaret?
You find small towns anywhere. I love to visit my agent up on the Upper West Side. We walk out onto the street. We walk down Broadway. She runs into her classmates' parents. She runs into old classmates, people she's known for years. My editor used to live down near the Village, and that was a whole different neighborhood, too. It was like a small town. Her husband knew every store owner, every hardware shop, every place she got the keys made, every deli. And it was like a small town. Now, take him above 14th Street, and he was lost. And I don't think Vicky would be that comfortable below 45th, maybe. But, so even New York City can be a small town
if
you've lived there long enough. Mm-hmm. And I do like writing about relationships and how the community impacts on each other. So, but it doesn't have to be a rural small town. It could be New York City.
It's so funny, Margaret, because I tell virtually an identical story about my agent on the Upper West Side. Mm-hmm. About, and that I had an epiphany about small towns the day I walked out with her. And we went to the little bitty grocery store, and they asked about her mother, and she asked about their kids. And we went to the dry cleaner, and they knew her by name, and she knew them by name. And she, just as you said, and I thought, this is her small town.
It is.
I grew up and I've lived all my life in the Kansas City area, and Kansas City's not a quote-unquote small town. And yet, I spent my early lives in a family. I was an only child, and we went to a big Presbyterian church. It took up an entire block. It was big enough to be a small town. It had enough members in it that it was like a small town. We were there Sunday morning, Sunday night, Wednesday night for potluck dinner. We were there for choir practice. I was there for Sunday school. I will say that I left when I was 13 and never went back. You know, you leave your small town. I loved it. It gave me such a sense of security and safety to have that small town in my big city. I love the idea of a compressed, well, it really goes back to the English Agatha Christie country manor. We make our small town is our country manor, and we have a certain number of people, and it's all kind of compressed, and emotions are compressed, and things can explode. Mm-hmm. And I think that can happen in any neighborhood in a city as well.
Oh, I do too. Mm-hmm. You know, violence and unhappiness and misery are everywhere. They're not just the back alleys. You know, they're in at the PTA just as well.
As is generosity.
Exactly,
and
kindness
heart,
and goodness.
The sort of thing that people associate with small towns without realizing they may be experiencing the same thing with their very kind next-door neighbors or whoever they may happen to be. Yeah.
You all have written series as well as non-series books. What are some of the advantages and disadvantages of working on a series as opposed to a non-series book?
Well, actually, I remember when I wrote the first book in the Death on Demand series, and I hadn't sold any books in a long time, and I was so fortunate, and it sold. And the agent said, well, they want to know if it's a series. And I said, oh, of course. And I had no idea.
It's never occurred to me. So the market entered into that as well. Right.
Yes, and I think now I feel so comfortable in a series. Uh-huh. I enjoy revisiting these characters. I still enjoy Annie and Max after all these years. They will always be young and happy on their sea island. And it's a pleasure to me to join them there. I love my new series with the red-headed ghost who comes back to a little town in Oklahoma. And I have probably bid farewell to Henry O. in the Henry O. series.
And why is that?
Because they want two books a year, and they want one Death on Demand and one ghost, and I can't manage any more
than
that.
You would be the ghost.
I would be the ghost, right. Yeah.
But
series are so much fun. You know, They give you this sense, it's that community, you know, mm-hmm. and it exists in your mind, just like Margaret with Colleton County.
I do feel like it's out there somewhere.
Exactly.
And every time I get to go visit it. But to address your problem, we can do this in short stories, do the different mm-hmm. voices mm-hmm. and do the different places. And as Nancy was saying, you can explore little facets of life that you couldn't necessarily in a novel. Certain things had happened to me. For instance, when I was a child, I remember very distinctly walking out one moonlit night when you could do this in the country and not worry about anything happening to you. And it was a beautiful moonlit night, and I walked down to the edge of the woods, and beyond that was the cornfield. And we heard corn. I heard corn growing.
Uh-huh.
You could actually hear the squeak and the pop
of the
plant because it had rained, and then the sun had shone on it, and it was 6 inches taller the next day. And so you could hear it growing.
And that is one of the most beautiful passages in Bootlegger's Daughter.
Mm-hmm. Well, thank you.
It is.
But I carried that image in my mind all the time that I was writing the New York books.
There's
not any corn
right.
growing
yes,
in that
right.
I'm sorry. So I didn't know what I was ever going to do with it, but then when I did start writing the Deborah Knott books set in the country, there it was, and I could use it. And so I really do enjoy coming back to the series, but I do also occasionally like to write something standalone. So far I've only written two standalone novels, but all of the short stories have pretty much
been standalone. That's mm-hmm. yeah, except for the cigarette stories,
yeah.
Right?
I am I the only one who's actually worked on three series here?
No, because I have three.
You have yeah. Of course, you have three too. Mm-hmm. Well, my third one was the three books I did for the Virginia Ridge Estate, and I loved working on series when I worked on them. But there came a point at which I really wanted to do third person, multiple point of view, and my series were first person. My Jenny Kane series was first person. Marie Lightfoot was well a mixture of things, but I wanted to do strictly third person.
But Nancy, you did that. You were the first one that showed me that you could mix.
Oh well,
first
I cheated.
And third.
That's true. I cheated. But Jenny was essentially. Margaret's talking about when I did Marriage's Murder for the first time. I had a situation in which mm-hmm. I really wanted the reader to be on the scene of the crime, and I couldn't get my first person heroine on that scene. So that's where the first chapter came, and that's when I did that for the first time, I believe. And it was kind of considered cheating in those days. But I thought if you do something while I'm writing, you can get by with anything.
Exactly. And you didn't mm-hmm. even necessarily start separate chapters. That's how I keep it differentiated now that I'm using third person and mixing first and third. Uh-huh. I will start a separate chapter so that I never lose the reader. But you did it so seamlessly in a couple of those Jenny books.
Mm-hmm. Oh, well, thank mm-hmm. you.
That
oh, good.
Even though you had first person part of the chapter, and then you had the big page break, mm-hmm. and then you got into the third person viewpoint, and you did it so seamlessly that I was halfway through the book, and I thought, hey, wait a minute. She's cheating. Oh, I wonder if I could do that.
I love that. Well, you know, the honest truth, and I'm just realizing it now as I'm sitting here, is I've actually tried first person when I've, in the two standalones I've done in the last few years, I've tried it when I've run into a problem. And I've written half of a book, sometimes rewritten it in first person, trying to see if I could make it work. And it didn't work. It's as if I can't write first person anymore. What it has done for me has been to give me greater insight into whatever character I'm writing in third person.
Exactly.
But I seem to have lost the knack to write in first person.
Oh, I doubt that.
I don't know if
it's riding a bicycle. Mm-hmm. You can get it.
Well, maybe. But I'm really happy doing third person. So,
well, I like third person. I do third person in the Death on Demand books because I can obviously move from viewpoint to viewpoint. But I very deliberately made my ghost book first person, and I do have to believe that the paranormal has exploded, and honestly, I wrote that book before that all started, and they sat on it for about 2 years. but what distinguishes the book, I think, makes it a little unusual, is that the ghost is the protagonist, and everything is seen from her perspective in first person. But what that does in that book is it's the omniscient viewpoint. Because, of course, she can disappear, and she observes people, and the only stricture is that whenever she's observing characters interacting and overhearing them, there has to be a real reason why she chose to be at that moment where she is.
I also think it's really important that Bailey be in first person because there's a certain sweetness to her point of view
yeah.
that I don't think anybody else can give, and that's such an important tone of those books.
Well, thank you, Nancy.
Mm-hmm.
I appreciate that.
Now, Nancy, I wanted to start with you with this question because I think when you did make that shift to non-series books, some reviewers said this is really a shift for you to more mainstream sort of books. So what do you feel the difference is between writing books that fit snugly into the mystery category and those that might be considered more mainstream?
Somebody recently described this for me in a way that made sense to me that I didn't understand. I am and always will be a mystery writer. That's where my heart is, that's where my head is, that's who I am. However, there came a point at which I wanted to do, as this person said, not even talking about me, I don't think, wanted to set a mystery in a larger tapestry of life. And for me, that meant more viewpoints, something that I call for my own use, a 360 view of an event. And I wanted to be able to go into all these heads around this event in order to show the impact on this. And I wanted to be able to see not just the events of detecting a crime. I wanted to know what happened before the crime, and I wanted to be there. I didn't want to I didn't want one character telling another. I wanted to be there. I wanted to be on the scene of the crime, and I wanted to follow people after the crime. That's a bigger book than I have been writing before. So if that makes it mainstream, then I guess I'm heading more toward mainstream territory. But what I feel as if I'm doing, I mean, and that would be fine. Mm-hmm. I'd be more than happy to have mainstream readers. But I just think it's real important for me as a writer to remember, you know, the old saying, dance with the one what brung you.
Right.
You know, mysteries brung me. So yeah. I'm going to keep dancing with mysteries at the good. Heart of whatever
I'm glad
I
to hear that. Margaret, your books are taught in courses of Southern literature, and you've also won literary awards. Do you make any distinction between the work that you do that is...
No, I'm like Nancy. I'm perfectly happy to be called a mystery writer. I really don't try to categorize my work or make definitive statements of it. I feel that that's the, you know, I write the books, I send them out. Whoever wants to take them can. They can say whatever they want to say about it.
Right.
I really don't care at this point. I really don't. I mean, I like a good review better than a bad review.
Sure, yes.
But as far as saying you're literary or you're not literary or you're trash or second rate, I don't care. That's nothing to do with me. I do the work. I do the best work I can. I put it out there, and then we see what happens.
Right.
You know, I really do think that's really true. I often think it's none of my business what somebody thinks of my work. You know, that's their business.
It's
exactly.
A subjective
It's their response is theirs.
That's right. Yes. And I'm like you. I'd much rather have a good review than a bad review. And if they want to go into hyperbole and talk about that, that's just
fine. And find symbolism.
Absolutely.
Yep. Right.
Be my guest.
The first time one of my works got picked up for a textbook, and it was a short story. And I'm reading the questions at the end of the short story. And they're saying, notice how the author did so-and-so. And did you catch the symbolism of the... And I'm going, really? Did you do that? My goodness.
We do a lot at the unconscious level that other people have to bring to our consciousness.
Yeah. I know. And when somebody does a paper on you, and it just blows my mind. I mean, that somebody's going to sit down and analyze my work.
Well, there are all sorts of scholars now of the mystery, and I'm sure they're studying your work and writing papers and dissertations. And
because I do issues that face the South.
Yeah.
I mean, I do try to, not every book, and I certainly try not to preach, but I do want my readers to think about some of the problems that we're facing here at the beginning of the 21st century. And I really hate it when I feel like that we are selling our birthright for a mess of pottage, to quote Genesis. I mean, as Nancy would tell you, half of my influence comes from Sophocles in the Bible.
Oh, okay.
That's right.
We were doing a panel together once at, where was that?
I don't remember. We've been on a few panels.
And somebody said, you know, where do you get your ideas? And I said, from the Bible and Sophocles. And and someone else said that she got hers from Mother Goose. We had a lot of fun with that panel.
Well, I always love the question of where do writers get their ideas. And, you know, some writers get really kind of snippy when they're asked that. And the truth of the matter is that almost everything in every book that a writer writes comes from some source. And the story I'd like to tell is, let me see which book is it. I think it was in Dare to Die, which came out a couple of years ago. A young man is talking to Annie, and he's describing the girl that he knew when they were both in second grade. And he looks at Annie, and he says, we were yellow birds. And she said, well, what was that? And he said, well, you know, the good readers were the bluebirds, and the okay readers were the redbirds, and then there were the yellow birds. And Iris and I were always the yellow birds. And there's more to that story, but the basic part of that story came from the fact that when my husband was in the second grade, the teacher divided the class into the bluebirds, the redbirds, and the yellowbirds. Mm-hmm. And my husband was a bluebird, but he never forgot the yellowbirds. Mm-hmm. And told me that story many years later. And then it ends up being a scene in a book more than 50 years later. No, 60. I mean, I won't
count. That's wonderful.
A good many years ago.
A good many years ago.
Yeah, I feel like sometimes we're like birds building a nest. You know, you take a string from here and a feather from over there, and by the time you finish, you've got your nest. Uh-huh. But to say that I'm going out and get just strings or I'm going out and just get feathers, no.
And sometimes you take somebody else's feather and somebody else's string. Like Carolyn took her husband's feather for the story.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. Well, you know, Mary Roberts Rinehart compared writers to crows, and she said that crows pick up bright objects and take them and hide them. And then when they want them, they go and get them. And that's what writers do. We collect odd and unusual and different things, but someday we'll use them.
The older I get and the longer I write, the more I'm aware of the fact that when I start a book, I can't do it unless it's some idea that has haunted me or won't let go of me. And you know, always people will say, well, do you worry that somebody's going to steal your ideas? And never. For one thing, if they use it, it'll become their idea and they'll put their own slant on it. But the other thing, and I also never worry about forgetting an idea. If I forget an idea, then it wasn't a strong enough idea to hold my attention. The ideas that go into my books are ones that may have been tugging at me for a very long time. And finally you have to work them out. If you can't work them out in life, then you can work them out in your fiction.
Right.
It's funny about, you were talking about the ideas, like you have a really rather important idea about your Judge Deborah stories in which you want people to be aware of what they're so blithely giving away in the terms of the beauty of North Carolina and other things about the heritage. My version of that is in Kansas. I live in a state, as does Carolyn to some degree, that is viewed as a stereotype by a lot of people abroad in the world.
Flyover state.
A flyover state. To me, my state, as Carolyn says to her, is beautiful. Mm-hmm. And I know these people intimately as real, whole people. And there's plenty of criticism abroad about Kansas, much of it richly deserved. But I'm happy to let other people write all that. What I want to write about is, and what's new and fresh, as far as I'm concerned, what surprises people is not the negatives, it's the positives. Yeah.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Exactly.
And I want to write about, I think, you know, we could all write, I could write about whatever is going on politically in Kansas at the moment, and there's always controversy of some sort. That's going to change 5 years from now, and it's going to change in another 5 years, but there's certain underlying values, and values is the wrong word, but certain underlying humanity in for both good and ill that doesn't change so much, and that is common, I think, to people all over. It's a truism, but we forget it when we stereotype an entire state. So, you know, somebody wise recently said that the minute you judge someone, you stop understanding them. So what I want to write about when I'm writing about my state of Kansas is that moment, but it's the place where you don't judge, you understand. And that doesn't necessarily have anything to do with anything contemporary. So I sort of aim for a tone that is kind of timeless, I hope, that isn't rooted in whatever's going on at the moment politically.
Oh, I feel that very strongly.
And I think that we share that, the three of us share that.
Well, Eudora Welty was famous for saying, let your stories grow out of the ground beneath your feet.
Oh, exactly. Yes, that's
wonderful.
And that's
exactly what that's we're trying to do, I think.
Yeah, I can see it so much in both of your work.
Well that's why I'm so happy to be writing a series set in Oklahoma. It's been such a pleasure, you know.
Well, when she was writing the Jenny King books, the Jenny King books were perfectly fine books set in New England.
They were
delightful. But the book that I loved the most was Bum Steer.
And
when she took her to Kansas and got her hands dirty.
That's right.
And it was so real.
Yeah. I don't know why it took me so long to... Even the Fort Lauderdale version that I wrote in Florida was more real to me because I knew it in a way that I had never known New England. Knew it and loved it.
And why did you choose New England originally for that?
Because some pretty mundane reasons when I was first starting out. At that time, regional mysteries were not popular and were not being bought. Mm-hmm. Virginia Rich was about the only one who had the nerve to set a mystery in a small Midwestern state, in a state, in a small town in the Midwest. And I thought, okay, I could write a novel, my first novel, about somebody in a small town in Kansas, and it's going to land on a New York editor's desk and it's going to go nowhere. Or I could set it in New England, which I've always loved and where I would live if I could. At least at that time I felt that way. And it would have a much better chance of selling.
Well, actually, that was the precise reason I chose South Carolina. And the reason why is that I wanted to use a vacation background for the mystery bookstore. And the only vacation background I knew well was Hilton Head, South Carolina, because we started going there in the 70s. And we've been going, 40 years now. Mm-hmm. I love South Carolina. They are so nice to me. They treat me like a South Carolina writer, and I am so appreciative. They're the kindest, nicest people. But what I really love about South Carolina is I love those alligators, those snouts
the
bay, and the Spanish moss. Now, can't you just see anything happening when there's Spanish moss?
Absolutely, yes.
And alligators.
Yes. It's the last alligator in Oklahoma. It's been
Well, actually, we do have them occasionally. It's so sad. Well, people have them as pets, and then they let them go. And, of course, the winter is usually too severe. They just caught an alligator the other day in one of our lakes. But we don't have them everywhere, and they're not 12 feet long and so ominous. Mm-hmm. Oh, they're amazing creatures. Mm-hmm. And they're everywhere, in South Carolina.
They really do look like something out of prehistory.
Oh, they do. They do. They're so powerful looking.
And they're fast.
Very fast.
30 miles an hour, apparently. Uh-huh. For only a short distance, though.
Yeah, but they got you.
They got you. That's right.
All you have to do is run 31 miles an hour. That's
And don't trip. Well, they always have a woman in the
Do not
movie.
Fall down.
Yeah.
Oh, gosh. This morning, Carolyn, you were saying something very interesting about, I probably won't get this quite right, about the greater scope that the traditional mystery allowed you over the suspense story or novel.
Yes. Well, my sense is that with the suspense novel, certainly you can have wonderful characterizations, but the emphasis is always upon pace. Mm-hmm. They build to the very fast, intense sense of excitement. And in the traditional mystery, what I really like the best is the fact that you get to know these people and you have a sense of them as real human beings and people who are struggling with temptation, with desire, with despair. Agatha Christie once said that the mystery was, the modern mystery, that they were parables. And that's how I see the mystery, because we're telling stories about people who have succumbed to sin. And we are seeing a graphic representation in the book of what happens in lives when people do not do what they should do. Mm-hmm. So, to me, the traditional mystery, I never make any apology. I am proud to be a mystery mm-hmm. writer. I think mysteries are incredibly important socially, and they are intellectually challenging. But most of all, mysteries are an affirmation of goodness. Mm-hmm. No one ever picks up a mystery unless they want the world to be a good place. Mm-hmm. So that's why we write them, and that's why people read them.
That's a wonderful summation of it,
yes,
isn't it?
Yes.
Well, I've kept you all here awfully late, and so I guess we probably should close soon. Is there anything, any other remarks?
Well, now we'll all line pet thinking about all the things
that we should say.
We can go on if you'd like.
We can rewrite it.
Well, thank you so much for doing this. I've enjoyed it so much. And
we kind of like each other.
I can tell that, and I think our listeners will see that too. So, well, good night then. Thank you.
It's been a long road, hasn't it, girls?
Yes, it has.
The music used in this podcast is a portion of O Summer Night from Donizetti's Don Pasquale. Its arranger is unknown. The recording was made in 1974 at a concert by the Music Division of the Library of Congress. Sound editing and mixing for the podcast were done by Emily Giuliarano.
You can subscribe to Ellery Queen's Mystery Magazine by visiting our website at www.themysteryplace.com/eqmm.